Thanks very much. Let me start by saying that this is joint work with Alex Andretta and Greg Hjorth. And let me also say that I'll be working throughout in L of R. And assuming ID. Yeah, so that's throughout the talk. Yeah, so let me start with the basic definitions. I'll start really with the basic definitions of the wage hierarchy. So let X and Y be two Polish spaces. Let A be a subset of X. And let B be a subset of Y. We say that A is wage reducible to B, write A wage less than or equal to B, if and only if A is a continuous preimage of B. Or more precisely, if and only if there is a continuous F from X into Y such that X belongs to A if and only if F of X belongs to B. This is for all little x in the space X. And so A is wedge reducible to B if and only if A is a continuous preimage of B. And let me say that A is wage equivalent to B if and only if both A is wage reducible to B and vice versa, B is wage reducible to A. Now I defined those concepts for general spaces for reasons which will become clear later on, but from now on let me just work with one space. That's the space omega to the omega. So work for now in this one space, omega to the omega, which I'll just call the real numbers. Okay, so let me give you a few facts about the wage ordering. So first, it's well-founded. It's due to marking. So theorem marking less than or equal to wage is well-founded. This means that given a set, we can look at its rank. Okay, so let's say that the wage rank of A is its rank in the wage ordering. Okay. And we sort of think of the wage ordering as a hierarchy of complexity on sets of reals. Let me make this a little more precise with the following definition. So alpha is an ordinal here. So let P alpha of R will be the collection of sets of wage rank at most alpha. So the collection of A such that the wage such that the wage rank of A is less than or equal to alpha. And let's use P less than alpha of R to denote the collection of A such that the wage rank of A is strictly smaller than alpha. And so this here you have a hierarchy. I mean, as you increase alpha, you get here more and more complicated sets. Okay? So it's a hierarchy of complexity on sets of fields. How does the hierarchy start? I'll draw the first three levels. That should give you a clear picture of everything. So first you have wage rank 0. What you have there is just the empty set and R itself, that is omega to the omega. Then you have wage rank 1. What you have there are the Clopen sets. Then you have rank 2, where you have the open and the closed sets. Now, as you go higher on the hierarchy, you get more and more complicated sets. Okay. So this is the picture of the beginning of the hierarchy. So let me list a few more facts about this hierarchy now. I'm going to use not A to denote the dual of A. Okay, so that's omega to the omega minus A. And I'll say that A is self-dual. If and only if the dual of A is wage reducible to A, in which case also A is wage reducible to its dual, so in fact they're equivalent. And otherwise, A is non-self-dual. Lemma due to wage, known as wage's lemma, which implies that every B is comparable either to A or else to its dual. Okay, so it doesn't say that this order is linear, but it's almost linear. Okay, so wage every B is comparable either to A or to its dual, or possibly to both. Now, this definition of dual and non-self-dual, it's not just a definition for specific sets, it's also a definition for the level on the wage hierarchy. Okay, so if one set, if A is self-dual, then all the sets which are equivalent to it in the wage ordering are self-dual, and also and similarly for non-self-dual. So let me write this down. So if sum A of rank alpha is self-dual, then all are. Okay, so it's a property really of the rank in the wage hierarchy, and we say in this case that alpha is a self-dual level. Similarly for non-self-dual. If you look at here at the picture of the beginning of the hierarchy, and here you have a non-self-dual level, right? You have empty and R, neither one is reducible to the other. Here you have a self-dual level, and here again you have a non-self-dual level. So open sets are not continuous preimages of closed set. Okay, so this is non-self-dual. This is self-dual. And this again is non-self-dual. And this picture, which you see at the beginning of the hierarchy, is typical for the entire hierarchy. So that is due to Steele and Van Wessep. They tell you that the self-dual and the non-self-dual levels alternate. Okay, so self-dual, non-self-dual levels. Alternate, exactly the way you see here. Also, they tell you that exactly what happens at limits. Okay, so limit levels of cofinality omega are self-dual, and limit levels of cofinality other than omega are non-self-dual. Okay, so you know exactly which levels are self-dual and which levels are non-self-dual. Let me just quickly draw a picture of this also. So let's say here we have alpha. And let's say that alpha is a limit of cofinality omega. In this case, it's a self-dual level, and P alpha of R is just this wedge degree of A, the collection of all sets which are continuous pre-images of A for any A of rank precisely alpha. Okay. And then P alpha plus 1 of R, well, it's a non-self-dual level. So it will look something like this. You take some set of rank alpha plus 1. It's not enough to take the set and its own continuous pre-images. You also have to take its complement because it's non-self-dual. Okay, so then after that, you again have a self-dual level. So you just take some set of that rank. And if it's enough to look at pre-images of that set, and nothing more. And so it continues, and then somewhere you get to a limit of cofinality greater than omega. It's non-self-dual, so again you have to take two sets. So you take some set D of that rank beta, but you also have to take its complement. Okay, so this is going to be P beta of R. Okay, so that's sort of the end of the basic introduction to the wage hierarchy. Well, except that I want to look at it a little bit differently now. Okay, so I want to look at these objects as quotients of some equivalence relation. Okay, so let's see be the set of continuous functions from omega to the omega into omega to the omega. And let me take some subset A of omega to the omega. Define an equivalence relation. For lack of better symbols, I'll call it E sub A on C as follows. The continuous function F is equivalent to a continuous function G if and only if they give you the same pre-image. Okay, so if and only if the F pre-image of A is equal to the G pre-image of A. Okay. Now you can think of this wedge class of A as just being the quotient of C by this equivalence relation. Right? When you note that the wedge class of A is just the collection of continuous pre-images of A, right? It's just Sorry? I forgot to. It should be somewhere here. I hope you left enough space. So I should have written it because it's not quite a standard definition. Well, I want to think of the wedge class of A as a collection of sets which are wedge less than or equal to A. Okay. So this is precisely a collection of continuous pre-images of A. I'm sorry about that. Okay, so now you can finally understand what I said on the other blackboard. Okay, so this is the wedge class of A. It's the collection of continuous pre-images of A. And you can think of it as the quotient of C modulo this equivalence relation E sub A. This is really somehow the same as C modulo E sub A. Right? You take all the continuous functions, but you can't just take all the continuous functions because some of them give you the same pre-image. So you factor by this equivalence relation. So in some sense, we can think of this, the wedge class of A is equal to C factored by the equivalence relation E sub A. So now let me make the following definition. I'll say that B sub wedge, the wedge class of B embeds into the wedge class of A. Well, that denotes the following statement. It's a statement you'd expect. I'm just going to say that this equivalence relation for B embeds into the one for A. So there exists some phi. From C into C, such that F and G are EB equivalent if and only if phi of F and phi of G are EA equivalent. That's for all continuous F and G. Okay, so these precisely are the phis which induce a one-to-one embedding of C factored by B, in other words, of the wedge degree of B into the wedge degree of A. Induce a one-to-one embedding of the wedge degree of B into the wedge degree of A. Just anything. Well, subject to the qualification that I work in L of R under AD. Right? So it's definable somehow. Okay, but it doesn't matter what I mean by definable, because AD will give me the tools I need to handle it. So I guess saying Borel would be too restrictive. So I don't want to say that. Okay. So now we can think of this P sub alpha. We can think of P sub alpha of R is again equal to C factored by EA. Well, except that sometimes you have to multiply by 2, right? Okay, so there is an abuse here. Maybe it's not just an abuse, but outright falsehood, okay? So it's a serious abuse. And that's because if alpha is non-self-dual, and P alpha of R is roughly 2 times C factored by E sub A, right? Because this thing gives you the wage degree of A. If alpha is non-self, if you're dealing with a non-self dual degree, then you have to take both the wage degree of the set and of its dual. Okay? So you roughly have to multiply by 2. But it doesn't matter much because mostly, except for the very first level, you're dealing with infinite collections. So multiplying by 2 just doesn't make any difference for the size. Okay, so from now on, I'll ignore these 2, and I'll just say that level beta embeds into level alpha. If you can embed C factored by EB into C factored by EA for some B in level beta and some A in level alpha, it doesn't matter which ones you take because they're all the same basically. Okay, so that denotes the segment B wage embeds into A wage, or in other words, there is some map on C which induces a map from the wage class of B into the wage class of A. And this is for some, equivalently for any B of rank beta and A of rank alpha. So now I can, so in some sense you're considering the sizes of these collections of sets, right? But you're considering the sizes subject to the restriction that you're working with some definable phi. So you're just looking at injections induced by some definable map phi. And now the question, the natural question for a set theorist is, do the sizes increase? And when exactly do they increase? Okay, so question. Let's fix beta. Can you embed level beta into some smaller level alpha? Can you embed level beta into the union of the smallest level? So does P beta of R embed into P less than beta of R? Okay, so in other words, I'm asking when do the sizes using definable phi increase? So let me actually write that down. So the question amounts to analyzing the growth along the wage hierarchy, but in terms of effective cardinalities. And that's because of the restriction that phi is definable in some abstract sense. So this is in terms of effective cardinalities. And of course, the question is meaningless if you're just dealing with cardinalities outright. Okay, so let me make this as a remark. Under AC, all those classes P alpha of R have size the continuum, well, except the first one, which has size 2. Right? So this is for alpha greater than 0. Okay, so under AC, the question is, it just degenerates. They all have exactly the same size. But here, with this restriction that the embedding is induced, the embedding between the quotient is induced by some embedding on the space itself, and that embedding phi has to somehow be definable, that makes the question meaningful. Okay, so under AC, the question degenerates. So the question degenerates. And this is why we work under determinacy. Where the question is meaningful. Okay, so that's the question. And what I'm going to do next is just give you the answer. Okay. Well, I'll divide into cases. So let me get rid of the easiest cases first. Okay, so let's first suppose that we're dealing with limit beta of countable of cofinality omega. So suppose first that beta is limit of cofinality omega. Well, in this case, you can't embed level beta into the collection of into the union of the levels below. And in this case, you get it essentially from Koenig's lemma. Okay, so this is an instance of Koenig's lemma. I'll tell you precisely which instance it is. So that's the instance that says that if kappa has cofinality omega, then kappa to the omega does not embed into kappa. Okay, I guess this particular instance of Koenig's lemma is, in fact, Cantor's diagonal argument. Okay, so you can think of it as an instance of Cantor's diagonal argument also. And let me also say how you use it. You use it with kappa equal to P less than beta of R. Okay, so just, I won't say any more, but if you run the proof of this instance of Koenig's lemma with this kappa, then what you will see is that P beta of R does not embed into P less than beta of R. Okay, so this is the first case, the case of limit of cofinality omega. Let me now handle successors, but again self-dual. I guess I should say that this is a limit of cofinality omega, and by the Steele van Wessep analysis, that's the same as self-dual limit. We know that the limit is self-dual if and only if it has cofinality omega. So let's now handle the self-dual successor. So suppose next that beta is a self-dual successor. Let alpha be the previous level. Okay, so let alpha equal to beta minus 1. Well, in this case, p beta embeds into p alpha, except for at the very beginning, and I'll say something about that later. So in this case, there is no growth in cardinality. You can embed p alpha plus 1 into p alpha, well, except for one case as below. Except for alpha equal to 0 as below, or c below. And let me try to sketch the argument for this, because later on I'll need a variant of that argument, which I won't sketch. So let's fix some A of rank alpha. Okay, so sketch. Fix A of rank alpha. Okay. And observe that A has to be non-self dual, right? And A is non-self dual. Why is that? Well, beta is a self dual level, alpha is the level before, and we know that self dual and non-self dual levels alternate by Steele van Wessep. Okay, so A has to be non-self dual. So now let's take A and its complement and join them. So let's A join dual of A denotes the following set. This is the set of 0 followed by x for x in A, union the set of 1 followed by x for x not in A. So this is just a way of putting A and its dual together into one subset of omega to the omega. Okay. So fact. This set, this join, has rank alpha plus 1. So let's take this to be our B. Okay, this is the, sort of the immediate successor in the wedge hierarchy of A. So let B be this set. Okay, so now I somehow want to map the wedge class of A, or embed the wedge class of B into the wedge class of A. And I'll do it by taking objects in the wedge class of B and associating to them some invariants, which will turn out to be essentially in the wedge class of A. And so this will give the embedding. Let's take something in the wedge class of B, or in other words, something which is a continuous preimage of A joined dual of A, and let's associate it to it the following objects. So for each B prime, let's let I0 of B prime be the set of neighborhoods on which B prime is wedge reducible to A. And let I1 of B prime be the set of neighborhoods on which B prime is wedge reducible to not A. Okay. And because B prime, the whole of B prime is wedge reducible to A join not A, well, this So if decomposition exhausts everything there is to know about B prime. Okay? So now let me look at what B prime does on those neighborhoods. So let's J0 of B prime, well, I'll write it this way, S sub X, so that S is in I0 of B prime. Okay, so on the neighborhood of S, B prime is reducible to A, and X is in that neighborhood and is in A. So X is in B prime, sorry, is in B prime. Okay, so this is just B prime restricted to neighborhoods on which it's wedge reducible to A. Now let's do the same thing for neighborhoods on which it's wedge reducible to the complement of A. So J1 of B prime is a set of SX so that S is in I1 and X, well, let me take the complement of B prime here. Okay, so B prime here is reducible to the complement of A, so let me take the complement. So X is in NS minus B prime. Okay. So now this tuple of objects is some sort of invariant. Well, we can think of this tuple, I0, I1, J0, and J1, is an invariant. Well, from this you can recover B prime. So what I mean by this is exactly that you can recover B prime from this invariant. And that's because, you know, B prime splits into the areas which are wedge reducible to A and the ones which are wedge reducible to not A. But this invariant, what is it? I0 and I1 are essentially real numbers. Right? They're just a list of neighborhoods. You can code them by real numbers. So this is R cross. Well, J0 and J1, they're both reducible to A. Right? They're both, in some sense, they're both continuous tree images of A. In the case of J0, it's because I just restricted to neighborhoods where you're continuous tree image of A. In the case of J1, because I restricted to neighborhoods where you were continuous image of pre-image of not A, but then I took the complement. Okay. So both J0 and J1 are basically in the wedge class of A. Okay. So what you have here is now an embedding. Okay. So you can use invariant to embed, well, the wedge class of B. So I started with some B prime in the wedge class of B. Into what? Well, into R across the wedge class of A. In other words, you can use it to embed P beta of R into R across P alpha of R. Or, in other words, to get to embed P beta of R into R cross P alpha of R. That's not quite P alpha of R. But it's almost the same. And if alpha is greater than zero, let me write this down. Well, then R, this part easily absorbs into P alpha of R. So you get that P beta of R embeds into P alpha of R. And if alpha is equal to 0, so this is the same as beta equal to 1. If alpha is equal to 0, then you don't use this argument. You just look at the objects. I wrote them down. At level 0, you have empty and R. At level 1, you have the Clopen sets. And it's clear that you can't embed the Clopen sets, an infinite collection, into 0 and R, right? So for alpha equal to 0, in other words, beta equal to 1, it's clear that there is no embedding of P beta of R into P alpha of R. What we did so far is handle all the self-dual levels, right? We handled self-dual successor levels, and before we handled limits of cofinality omega. In other words, we handled self-dual limits. So what's left is to handle non-self-dual level. So let's now suppose that beta is non-self-dual, and let's fix some B in the class beta. So fix some B of rank beta. So now I'll describe something that I call a natural attempt. Okay, and I hope after you've seen the case of the successor dual, you'll agree that it's natural. And this is sort of the natural attempt to find some alpha smaller than beta so that P beta of R embeds into P alpha of R. Okay. What is this natural attempt? Well, what you try to do is you try to decompose B into sets of smaller rank. In the same way that here you decompose the self-dual B into components of smaller rank. Okay, so you try to decompose B into sets of, or into components, let me say. In fact, into countably many components of rank. Let me say of smaller rank, of rank smaller than beta. Well, in much the same way the self-dual B was decomposed into A plus not A. Okay, so you try to find neighborhoods on which B has smaller rank. Remove those neighborhoods, see what happens. Try again to find neighborhoods on which you can lower the rank, and keep doing this until hopefully you just manage to decompose B into countably many objects of smaller rank. Okay, so if you can do that, well then, in that case, you let alpha less than beta be the supremum of those smaller rank, and then you use invariants, just as you used in the self-dual case, to embed p beta into p alpha. Again, in much the same way you did in the self-dual case. And so there is some natural attempt to try and take P alpha of R, sorry, P beta of R, and embed it into a smaller level. And so the question that's left is, what if this natural attempt failed? Okay. So far we've exhausted all the possibilities. Okay, we've handled the self-dual case, we've handled the non-self-dual case if the natural attempt to decompose B succeeds. What if it fails? Okay, so then you have the following corollary. Let me just, it has some qualification. Let's assuming that B has a representative in 2 to the omega. In other words, i.e., there is some subset of 2 to the omega which is wedge equivalent to B, where this is considered in the space 2 to the omega and this is considered in the case.
What is the corollary?
It's a corollary of a theoremal state in Wahl. Yes. Yes, that's a good question. So this assumption, well, I guess Louvot gives his personal guarantee that it's true for all Borel sets. And it seems to be true for all sets outright. In fact, it seems it was known for all sets outright, but so long ago that it was forgotten. Okay. So that doesn't seem to be much of a qualification. So under this assumption, suppose this natural attempt to decompose B fails. Well, in this case, P beta of R does not embed into any lower level. Okay. Then, in fact, P beta of R does not embed into the union of the smaller levels. So if this natural attempt fails, you really have something of bigger size. So this corollary answers the question, the initial question, completely. So we now know exactly when growth occurs along the wedge hierarchy. It occurs exactly when it occurs whenever it can, subject to the qualification of those natural attempts. Let me actually write it down. This answers the question completely, well, with the self-dual cases that we handled before. And the answer is that with effective cardinality, grows whenever it can, basically. Well, subject to the qualification of the non-self-dual successor and the qualification of this natural attempt. So subject to, well, or the restrictions, subject to the constraints of the self-dual successor and the natural attempt in the case of non-self-dual degrees. Okay, so subject to those two constraints, effective cardinalities grow whenever they can. Okay, so now the last thing I want to do is state a theorem. I'm not as ambitious as Howard. And this will be the theorem that leads to corollary one. Okay, so let me... now work to state the theorem that leads to corollary one. I'm going to need a few more definitions for that. So let Cn for n less than omega be an increasing sequence of closed sets. And let's Fn from Cn into omega to the omega be Lipschitz. So now define the function h F using the following two conditions. So first, its domain is just the union of those closed sets, the increasing union of the closed sets. Then the values it takes are, well, for x in the domain, h of x is equal to fn of x for the least n, so that x is in C sub n. Okay, so for n least such that x is in C sub n. So in some sense it's the union, you can think of it as the union of those Lipschitz functions maybe. Okay, something like that. And let me call functions which arise in this way normal functions. So those are the normal functions. And just another definition. So B sub normal, if it's written sharp, but it's pronounced normal. Okay? This is just the collection of normal pre-images of B. Okay? So this is the set of H minus 1 of B, where H is a normal. Function. And the main theorem which leads to corollary one is the following result. That's again assuming that B has a representative in 2 to the omega, this annoying assumption that's necessary but seems to be true. Well, so suppose that B, so, and this is for B, which is non-self-dual. If you can embed B sharp, B normal, into the wedge class of A, well, then it must be that A sits above or at the same level as B in the wedge hierarchy. Then B is either wedge continuously reducible to A or to its complement. So either way, it must have rank at least as high as the rank of B.
Okay. Why does normal reduction not depend on the representative of the wedge class?
Well, that's because it's more than continuous reduction. Okay. So, corollary to that, and that's for the same B, let beta be the rank, the wedge rank of B, then, and let alpha be something smaller. Then you can't embed B normal into P alpha. Right? This is just the way, a way of saying exactly the same thing. If you could embed B normal into, this is basically P alpha, then alpha would have to be greater than or equal to beta. So if alpha is smaller, you can't embed B normal into P alpha. And in fact, this can be strengthened to tell you that in fact, you can't embed B normal. It's not just that you can't embed it into each individual level, you can't embed it even. Sorry?
No.
Oh, that's right, yes. Otherwise, well, so it's not just that you can't embed it into any individual level, you can't even embed it into their union. Okay. And this gives you corollary one. So what is this? Well, this is basically B wedge, okay? And here you have B normal. But it's easy to check that if this natural attempt to decompose B fails, then B wedge is in fact closed not just under continuous preimages, but also under normal preimages. Well, either it or its complement is closed under normal preimages. So in fact, this is the same as B normal, well, either for B or for its complement. So modulo, so you take this theorem and add to it the fact that if this natural attempt to decompose B fails, then you get closure under normal functions. You get this corollary. Okay, so let me stop here.